We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Images greet travelers with a smile.
At Paris's Orly Airport, strikingly lifelike video images greet passengers and direct them to their boarding gates. The illusion experiment is being met with a mix of amusement and surprise by travelers who frequently try to touch and speak with the agents. Authorities came up with the idea for the 2D holograms as a way to modernize a wing of the airport with dozens of boarding gates and scores of departures every day. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Noirmoutier, France.
High-tech alarm systems for cars may be vulnerable to computer hackers. Security consultant Matthew Skolnick says hackers using a laptop can send specifically crafted text messages directly to the anti-theft system.
By doing that, we connect to your car, send it certain commands, and those commands include unlock, start, just about anything we'd like to do, we can do to your car.
Checking Wall Street, the Dow is up 19 points. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're very happy to have back here on the program once again, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois and has been a regular guest on the show for quite a while now, on stopping by once a month on a Friday to talk about money management and investing. And the way we do this is he begins and he asks a few comments about where we are right now, certainly a very confusing and troubling time, and how maybe you might want to adjust your strategies to fit that. And then if you have questions on that or anything else, this is really a show where we're trying to help individuals with their own particular situation. So if you have a question for yourself, you certainly can call in and Dave will try to help you out. And with that, we say, well, welcome back. It's been a while.
Well, it has, David, and good morning. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, let's get right to it. The economy, I guess it's on everyone's mind, your mind, my mind, everyone's mind. And of course, when we cavalierly use the term economy, we really need to add the modifier global, because we do live and must operate in a global economy, and it's certainly the case over the last 5 to 6 weeks, as we have evidenced. For example, yesterday, it was reported that German economic growth is screeching to a grinding halt, typified by a lack of exports and a greater influx of imports. Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, has publicly stated that she doesn't support the concept of the EU countries collectively guaranteeing the vast sovereign debt of several of its members, including the most recent being Italy, previously thought to be one of the stronger members of the EU. This is especially bad news for banks, bad news for financial institutions around the world holding Greek, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish bonds, as the threat of sovereign debt and sovereign default looms. This would have an enormous impact on the international banking industry. This is part of the issue, part of the reflection in world stock markets. The short-term market reaction, of course, is a crisis of confidence reflected in not only the European stock markets, but yesterday's obvious drop in the U.S. markets of approximately 4.5%. And as we know, it is indeed a global world. And in the United States, the term recession is on all of our minds. And as we know, the classic definition of recession is really two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth or negative GDP in real terms. Now, while the economy continues to grow somewhere around the 2% number, the stark reality is that for many Americans, they've been mired in their own personal recession for months and perhaps even years. For example, almost 14 million Americans who are currently seeking a full-time job have been unemployed 27 weeks or more. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in their July statistics that they report on their website. And indeed, more than 7 million Americans are currently drawing unemployment benefits. And what's essentially a terrible, terrible blight and a terrible blight on our economy, 20% of kids age 16 years of age or younger are eligible for subsidized benefits, subsidized lunches at school. Those were 2009 statistics, not 2010, not 2011, 2009 statistics. Today, it's probably higher. And at the same time, consumers paid more for gas, more for food, more for clothes in July. As the Labor Department said Thursday, that the CPI, the Consumer Price Index for July, rose a full 0.5%. And in fact, over the past 12 months, consumer prices have risen almost 4%. Now, a lot of that is gasoline, a lot of that is oil. And for our stock market investors, well, it's been a bloody 4 weeks, with major averages plummeting 15% or more, erasing approximately $3 trillion of paper wealth. So there goes Professor Inge's paper wealth. He feels poor today, ladies and gentlemen, so he's probably not spending quite as much. Interestingly enough, while $3 trillion of paper wealth has disappeared among investors in the stock market, that's about the amount of dollars, $3 trillion, that Fortune 1000 companies have in their coffers sitting waiting to do something with. They are cash rich. It's one of the highest levels of cash in the history of Fortune 1000 companies. And indeed, despite stock market prices, profitability has never been better for these companies. Are they hiring? No, they're not hiring. What are they doing with their excess funds? Are they investing them? No. They're parking them in 0% treasury bills. That's what's really happening at the current time. Now, in my view, there are four major factors influencing our current stock markets. First, obvious fears of a second recession among all of us. We hear the term over and over and over again. Two, the psychological impact from the loss of our AAA credit rating as determined by S&P. That has not only spooked some U.S. investors, it has clearly spooked many international investors. Three, the acknowledgement and realization of the sovereign debt crisis in Europe and its potential devastating impact on international financial institutions, especially European banks. And four, the perceived inability, and this is a big one, the perceived inability of governments, both at home and abroad, to solve economic problems, in part due to the tremendously divisive ideological positions staked out by our elected officials and our political parties. The confluence, it seems to me, of these four factors has tremendously hurt consumers in terms of their confidence. Consumer confidence is at an all-time low, which in turn makes our business sector even more reluctant to hire more workers, because it is feared that consumers will continue to spend even less. And more consumers, as we hear every day, are doing more and more of their business, even in cash. After all, we are still a consumer-driven economy with fully 70% of our GDP relying on the economic behavior of consumers. Additionally, job creation in the U.S. continues to be an uphill battle, especially when 6 out of every 10 jobs created by a Fortune 500 company is a non-U.S.-based job. Isn't that interesting? Our Fortune 500, which are headquartered in the United States, 6 out of every 10 jobs that they are creating are foreign-based jobs. All right. So it should be no surprise that stocks are hemorrhaging. And indeed, even our couch potato portfolio is no exception, despite its apparent diversification. Now, you'll recall that the portfolio consists of 8 Vanguard index funds, which can be accessed and generally followed on the WILL website, although it is not up as of today. I understand in the next few days it will be up. So check back by clicking on Focus and then click on the David Sinnoh Couch Potato Portfolio. Now, on May 19th, our portfolio was breezing along. We apparently had the wind at our backs, and we were breezing along with a 7% gain year-to-date. Through last night's close, however, our portfolio for the year was a negative 11.74%. Why, that seems to be a rather volatile move of 18%, David, I think in the wrong direction. So we are negative 11.74% for the year. And interestingly enough, as compared to our benchmark, which is the S&P 500 index, the S&P is down a little over 8% for the year, about 8.24%. So our actual portfolio, which includes Europe, it includes the emerging markets with 30% of our funds, it includes big caps, small caps, those have underperformed our benchmark S&P 500. Indeed, one of the few asset classes that continues to hold up is the REIT, R-E-I-T, index class. And that includes apartment buildings, offices, shopping centers, etc. And that is about delta neutral for 2011. So it's outperforming, but approximately 7% of our overall 100% of our equities are in REITs. Now, I am continually asked, is now a good time to invest? It's a legitimate question. And generally, I respond with two answers. First, if you are going to invest in the stock market, as I have counseled time and time and time again, then you must adopt a long-term time horizon. 5 years, 3 years, 1 year, 10 years is simply not enough. You have to make a very long-term commitment to the market, because otherwise you're going to get whipsawed. You can't possibly compete with computer trading. You can't possibly compete with micro, mini-second trading. It's an impossibility for the average investor. You have to look at it over a long term. And second, now more than ever, dollar-cost averaging into a position makes great sense. So dollar-cost averaging into a position over the next 12 to 18 months, it seems to me, is a reasonable thing to do with money that you are investing for the long term. So, for example, if you were investing $25,000 into the stock market, perhaps invest 1/12 of that or even 1/18 of that on a regular basis each month. For those of you in 403B programs, for those of you in 401K programs, this is automatically done for you. Don't reduce the amount that you are putting aside for retirement. Because every month when that $1,500, $200 goes into your 401k and buys stocks, it is buying stocks at cheaper prices. You are buying more shares at cheaper prices. And at the end of the day, this is not about a price accumulation business. It is about a share accumulation business, because shares ultimately pay dividends. And shares ultimately appreciate. So the truth of the matter is, if you are still in the accumulation phase, then you should be reasonably happy, because you are buying more and more shares at less expensive prices, and that's what dollar cost averaging does for you. And remember, no one with any certainty or regularity can predict the highs and lows of the stock market. If you look at Fortune magazine and you look at the Fortune 500 wealthiest Americans, none of them are traders. None of them are brokers. Isn't that interesting? Lots of them are entrepreneurs. Lots of them are business people. Lots of them are industrial giants. But none of them seem to be computer traders who trade up and down on the markets. Averaging into a stock market makes great sense. And indeed, if you have to pull money out of the stock market, average out of a position. Just as you can average in, you can average out. Well, so there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to address questions on our listeners' minds on topics that I've raised, or more specific wealth management questions, financial planning questions. The only other thing I will say is I really don't want to spend a lot of time talking about politics and political questions. They're great questions, but I think that's for another program. You could probably have a plethora of programs in that area.
All right. And we have, and I'm sure we will. But there you have it, folks. This is a program we do every month. We've been doing it for a long time. And what we hope that we can do is help you as an individual with your own planning, your strategic financial decisions, what you do with your money. And if you have a question for yourself, just give us a call. Give us a little bit of information. Dave might want to ask you a couple of things. But he will do his best to give you some advice and help you out. So 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We do also have a toll-free, an email. So if you'd like to send your question by email, you certainly can do that. That is will-talk@illinois.edu. And I was thinking about you all along here, at least during the past couple of weeks when there seemed to be so much bad news. We got the downgrade, there was all of the disruption in the market that had to do with the conflict over the approaching debt ceiling. And after that, you would open the paper and you go to the financial section, and person after person was saying what I knew it would be that you would say the same thing. They were saying, okay, yeah, things are not looking real good now, but that does not, don't rush out and do anything precipitous. Hang in there, be patient, don't panic. It's the thing that you have said for so long about how you got to be in it for the long haul, and you're just going to have to hang on and ride this out.
That's right. I saw 1972, 1973, 1987, 1990, the 2000 tech bubble. We've seen a number of cases, but here is the inevitable bottom line. And that is that if you commit at least a portion of your portfolio, and maybe it's 20%, 25%, 30%, maybe it's 40%, maybe it's 100%, it depends on your situation. If you commit that portfolio and that position to a long-term strategy, 25, 30, 35 years, the bottom line is invariably that strategy outperforms the best fixed income that money can buy.
Now, we're about mid-year, a little bit past mid-year, so it may be a while before you would be talking about rebalancing of the portfolio. That's something that you kind of talk about at the end of the year.
Exactly.
But, you know, given some of the things that you've said, and particularly the fact that there's a lot of concern about what's going on in Europe, had you given any thought, or are you thinking about possibly changing the allocation that has to do with those money going into those markets?
That's a great question. That's a different question than rebalancing the portfolio. That's a fundamental asset allocation question that goes to how you're going to allocate your dollar over a variety of asset classes. Yeah. Currently, the couch potato portfolio has 30% of its funding in foreign stocks, right? And that really consists currently of the Vanguard Total International Index with approximately 27% and 3% in the Vanguard Emerging Markets. Now, interestingly enough, the Vanguard Total International Index is really an index of indexes. So for a dollar in that total international index, 15 cents of that dollar is in emerging markets. So we really have a larger position, more like a 7% position overall in emerging markets, and about a 23% position in Europe and the Far East and other emerging markets around the world. So I am looking at that, but that would be a decision that would be made December 31 in next year's portfolio.
Okay. We have a caller here, and I would welcome others, and we'll get started here with someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yes. Yeah. I'm considering investing in some large cap American bank stocks, but I don't want to just buy one at a time like Bank of America, you know, with that risk, and Citicorp or HSBC. What's the strategy for combining bank stocks, you know, in a basket or something other than buying individually?
Well, I would tend to agree with your strategy of not buying one individually, because then you're subjecting yourself to unsystematic risk. And it would be just my luck, if I was choosing, that five would go up and the one or two that I chose would go down. So there are a number of mutual fund choices, and I'm not certain if there is an ETF choice, but there are some mutual fund choices that basically put together a fund in which bank stocks are the primary investment vehicle, as well as insurance companies. And I like the concept of combining both. And Fidelity has a fund like that, which you might take a look at. And if you Google bank mutual funds, you probably will find two or three others as well. But I would say that what you're really doing then is you are doing something called sector investing. And if you are going to invest in an individual sector like a financial sector, which is really banks and insurance companies, I would proceed with caution. I would certainly not have in any given sector more than 7 to 10% equity exposure of my total portfolio. That would be more than enough.
That's very helpful. I appreciate the information.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. And again, others, if you have questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu.
David, I don't want to sound like Mr. Doom and Gloom today. Obviously, there's a lot of bad news out there. It's tough. There are a lot of structural issues. This is not the end of the world. This is nothing like that. We're going to recover from this eventually. There are some good items out there. There are some little golden nuggets, and not counting the price of gold, by the way. But rates on 30- and 15-year mortgages are really the lowest since the records have been kept. You're talking about amazing rates on single-family dwellings, somewhere in the low fours, as low as I've seen mortgage rates even in our local community now, at about 4.2% on 30-year money. That is very, very cheap money, especially going forward, because if that 4.2 is locked in with inflation, you're paying back your lender in cheaper and cheaper and cheaper dollars at very low interest rates. And indeed, the 15-year mortgage rates are at about 3.5. So is it a good time to buy homes? Well, probably in a stable Midwestern community like Champaign-Urbana, for example, it's probably a great time to buy a home, especially if you can qualify for these extraordinary rates. Now, are rates going to get away from us? I don't think so, because the Federal Reserve, Mr. Bernanke, has already announced that they intend to keep interest rates about where they are for the next year, maybe even into 2013. So it's not like you have to rush out tomorrow, but these rates aren't going to hang around forever. You might consider refinancing. Now, a lot of people have run into an appraisal issue, and that is that they bought a home for maybe $150,000, $200,000. They put 20% down. Maybe they have a 5.5% mortgage. They said, gee, I think we could go out and refinance at a lower interest rate, save a couple hundred dollars a month, and now the appraisal comes through, and it shows that the house is worth less than it was when they bought it. This is partially because of the number of short sales, partially because of the number of foreclosures, and the general depreciation of residential real estate in general. However, there is no one able to tell us where the bottom is. That's an impossibility. You know, it's just too difficult. So for people who are sitting on the sidelines thinking about either refinancing, and they have substantial equity in their particular home, or they're thinking about buying a home for the first time or moving, it's really a pretty decent time to do that, especially in stable communities. And I'm talking about communities like a Champaign-Urbana, like a Bloomington, Illinois. Those are very, very stable communities, huge health industrial giants in both communities, large educational giants in both communities, and surrounded by tremendous agribusinesses. So those are very, very stable. And I think that you're going to see prices starting to appreciate in the next 12 months in these particular communities.
All right. Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest this morning, David Sinnoh, is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And once a month, it's always on a Friday, he is here to answer questions. And so, again, if we can help you out on your personal investing decisions, you pick up the telephone and give us a call.
Well, something else I wanted to visit with you about, and that is there seems to be this push and pull about should wealthy Americans pay more in income taxes. Mm-hmm. You'll recall that several years ago under the administration of George Bush, there were significant tax cuts. And indeed, part of the compromise with the recent increase in the deficit and raising the ceiling, that taxes remained the same. Some people were pretty unhappy about that. Some people are pretty happy about that. But what does Warren Buffett think about taxes on billionaires and very wealthy Americans? And you know what he says? He says on the front page of the New York Times, approximately, when was this? A couple days ago.
Yeah.
He said, you know, we're not paying enough taxes. And in fact, Warren Buffett says, I'm paying less as a percentage of my overall income than I've ever paid in my life. And the truth of the matter is that I can afford to pay far more. Those are the words of Warren Buffett. And basically he said, there's been an argument going around that says, oh, if we raise taxes on entrepreneurs, they're going to be less likely to be entrepreneurial. They're going to be less likely, and they're just going to sit back and, I guess, do what David Sinnoh does, is go fishing for muskies in Wisconsin. That's what's going to happen to everyone, and the economy is going to fold. Here's what he said. I've worked with entrepreneurs. I've worked with investors for 60 years, and I have yet to see anyone, not even when capital gains rates were 39.9% in 1976 and 1977, shy away from a sensible investment because of the tax rate on the potential gain. People invest to make money, and potential taxes have never scared them off. And to those who argue that higher rates hurt job creation, I would note that a net of nearly 40 million jobs were added between 1980 and 2000 when rates were significantly higher. All right. Well, there may be a lot of other reasons why we created that number of jobs during that period of time, but I find it instructive. I find it most interesting that our probably wealthiest American, Warren Buffett, is saying, you know, wealthy people in America could pay more, and it is not going to impact their entrepreneurial spirit. It is not going to impact their likelihood to stop investing. And I think that's very, very instructive. And at the same time, Mr. Buffett has taken a tremendous amount of his personal net worth and has donated already to the Gates Foundation. He has publicly stated that at his death, since he's great at making money but not very good at distributing money, that the lion's share, the vast, vast percentage of his estate is already committed to the Gates Charitable Foundation.
Yeah, and I don't know if his children publicly commented on their dad's assertion that they need to go out and make their own money and he wasn't going to be passing on any of his to them.
Well, I'm not certain, but I did see, and I can't remember the magazine article that I read on the children, and I believe that Mr. Buffett provided them each with approximately $100 million.
He
wanted to see what they were going to do with it, how they were going to invest it, what kinds of charitable endeavors they were going to get involved with before he decided what to do with some of his other funds. I find that very interesting and very instructive.
$100 million. I'm going to have to call my dad as soon as we get off the air. I said, Dad, we need to talk. Our guest this morning, this hour of Focus, is David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance here in the College of Business. He's with us once a month. We talk about money management, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM 580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM 580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and calls. I'll just mention that in the second hour this morning, our guest will be Douglas Waller. He's a journalist and writer, and he's written a new biography of William Donovan, the man whose nickname was Wild Bill, Wild Bill Donovan, who was the creator and head during World War II of the OSS, the Office of Special Services. It was the Foreign Intelligence Gathering arm of the U.S. government, provided information to the military in their war in Europe and in the Pacific, and very much helped to dictate the form of what came next, the CIA. We'll talk about Donovan. He was quite an interesting character with Doug Waller in the next part of the show. Also, I do want to mention, too, that next week, on Tuesday, I'll have another conversation with the president of the University of Illinois, Michael Hogan. He's been on the job a little bit more than a year. We'll talk about some of the challenges of his first year. This will be a live show. We will take calls, and that will be on Tuesday, the 23rd, at 9 o'clock in the evening. We'll broadcast it on WYLL-TV, also AM and online. So it's a live show. We will take calls that night. But if you'd like to submit a question in advance, you can do that, too, by writing to our email site, willtalk, we've got to get the hyphen in there, will-talk@illinois.edu. And the guest this morning in this hour is David Sinow. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. This is our monthly show on money management. And if you have questions, call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a very short email, but I will give it to you because was referencing your comment about averaging in and averaging out. The person who was listening says, isn't it true that you should invest by the dollar but redeem by the share?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. No. I mean, one is called dollar cost averaging, and the other is called share cost averaging. And generally, you could do either, but you adopt one or the other strategy.
Okay. All right, then. We have another call. We have a caller here in Peoria, line number 4, the toll-free. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Yes.
I just went with a financial planner, and, you know, all these stocks, as you said, I went from Thrivent to Vanguard. Now, you know, personally, I think it doesn't matter anymore. I think the stock market's going up, down like a yo-yo, and I think it's kind of moody. And, you know, I don't know where to – honestly, I'd like to take the money out and put it under my mattress cover, because I honestly don't trust the stock market. I don't trust banks anymore either, because if they want to make money, it seems like, you know, they just find another way to add another fee. My question would be, having the chaos going on right now with the stock market, how safe do you feel about the stock market and in the banking industry in general? I just have to admit, I listened to a program a couple weeks ago on, I think it was CNBC, with John Stossel. I don't know if you're familiar with the guy. He's a reporter.
Yes.
The way he explained it, the severity of the banking system, how the corruptness is, how there's certain groups of individuals that are running the banking system itself. He said it's a major problem, and nobody wants to bring it out. And he had a bunch of people that were on there. There were investigators trying to investigate things, and he basically, the guys that they were talking to said they were told to hands off with the investigation, stop investigating. Now, you know, I concern myself with the financial status of this country right now because of what's going on in Europe, but do you think there's any reason for me to be kind of, I don't want to say paranoid, but concerned?
Well, all of us can be concerned, but don't be paranoid. First of all, your money is safe in banks. It is FDIC insured, which really means it has the government backing. So whether you are flying to safety in treasuries, which are essentially paying T-bills, which are essentially paying zero, or you are in low interest rate savings accounts or certificates of deposit, in that sense, your money is safe. In other words, there isn't going to be a default on that money. In terms of the purchasing power of that money, that depreciates each day. And that's another issue that has to do with inflation. It has to do with the relative value of the American dollar versus other dollars abroad and other currencies abroad. But in terms of the financial safety of your dollar, someone not repaying you that dollar, I don't have that feeling at all. I don't have that problem. I don't believe that, and I don't think you should worry about it, and don't be paranoid about it.
What about gold?
What about gold?
Yeah, well, what do you think about the gold? Because I actually think it's going that route to where gold is going to be the money factor. I think the dollar has been so devalued, and people using, you know, the metals for currency instead of I could see that actually happen. I mean, we're competing against China and some other countries that it's a one world economy. And I don't know how we're going to coexist with other people without changing it up somewhere.
Well, with reference,
I'll get up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, what you're hearing is concern. You're hearing fear. You're hearing confusion, etc. Look, number one, we are still the strongest economy in the world. Number two, our treasury instruments, there's not going to be a default. Our bank is not going to default on FDIC deposits because they are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Number three, people are pouring into gold, but as a hedge against devaluation of currency because of the future impact of potential inflation, and that in times of fear, in times of confusion, in times of difficulty, historically, people have poured into gold and gold, whether it's the precious metal itself, whether it's the coins, whether it's the gold mutual funds backed by gold, gold ETFs, etc. And it is true that gold has now moved beyond $1,800 an ounce. It's almost a meteoric rise, and we have seen meteoric rises in other commodities, and ultimately they come back to earth. But as a hedge in your portfolio, with 2-3% of your overall portfolio, I'm not going to object to someone putting on a hedge. As far as taking all of your money and flying into gold, I would have severe problems with that. I would strongly counsel against that.
Yeah, it's striking that here within the price of gold has more than tripled within the last
three years.
So it's not, you don't have to go too far back in your memory. Yeah, now it's over 1800, but you don't have to go too far back when it was like 400
and most of this meteoric rise has taken place in the last few months.
And I'm sort of the feeling that if everybody's rushing into something, it's probably the time to say, no, wait a minute. Do I really want to rush with all these other people?
Well, there is an enormous appetite for gold. There is an upward pressure on the metal at the current time, lots and lots of demand for it because of the tremendous economic difficulties that are being really felt worldwide.
Yeah. Well, so I was just thinking about, and you really have touched on it, I was thinking earlier you were talking about the tremendous opportunity now because interest rates on mortgages are so low that if you're in the market for a home, and it's going to be the home that you're going to live in, and you're in a good market, and you can qualify for the financing, that's a fabulous time to buy a house. The flip side of those low interest rates are low interest rates. And now if you're trying to find some place to put some money, and this is savings, and maybe you want to be able to get at it, but essentially this is a long-term savings. It's money that you're going to put away for another day. The interest rates now for a while have been pretty disappointing
and probably will continue to be disappointing.
You know, so what's the alternative?
Well, there aren't a lot of good alternatives because, again, one of the reasons – there are two major reasons that interest rates, it seems to me, remain very, very low and will remain low for a significant amount of time. One is, if interest rates move up even 1%, think about this. Our overall national debt, for example, is about $13 to $14 trillion. 1% of that number is another $130 to $140 billion of interest, which we as a government, which we as a federal government, cannot afford. So as a result, there is tremendous pressure to keep interest rates low, especially when we have overcapacity in our factories, we have lots of unemployment, so we don't see lots and lots of long-term wage push inflation. So that is one reason. And number two, the truth of the matter is that our banks are still trying to recapitalize themselves. They are holding vast amounts of real estate and real estate mortgages that have not been negotiated, not been brought to the market, not been foreclosed. So while balance sheets in terms of their capital to deposits look relatively happy, if we really took a hard look at some of the asset values on those balance sheets, that they need to essentially raise more capital. How are they doing that? Well, they're raising more capital by essentially taking our deposits and paying us nothing on those deposits and loaning them either back to the government or loaning them in private industry and earning a net interest rate spread. So banks' net interest rate spread continues to increase. And what are they doing with that additional profit? They are rebuilding their balance sheets. So as long as banks need to rebuild their balance sheets, which is extremely important so that they can loan money, so they can reduce the tight underwriting standards, so businesses can have more access to money, but until they have rebuilt those balance sheets, it's going to be difficult to seek out higher interest rates. So here's what some fairly wealthy middle-class families are doing. Mm-hmm. They're loaning money to their kids. That's what they're doing. They're paying off college loans and saying, look, you've got to pay 6% interest on those college loans. Pay 4% interest. Look, you want to go out and buy a home, and national mortgage rates are 4.5, 4.25 for 30 years. We'll take 3.5 for 30 years. So that's what's happening. Hmm. So you are actually loaning money intra-family. This is becoming very, very popular. Now, be careful. If you're going to do this, it's important that you have a lawyer draft a note, a lawyer draft a first mortgage instrument. The first mortgage instrument has to be recorded, and then you have to make certain that this is a business relationship and these monthly payments indeed are made. Then there is a benefit to both parties. The lender, of course, is earning a higher rate of return. And, of course, the borrower is paying a lower rate of return and at least currently still getting an interest deduction on that money because mortgage interest is still deductible so long as you are itemizing on your tax return.
I have a couple of email questions here to ask, and we also have somebody here on the phone, so let me get to the emails. We have someone who writes, I earned $100,000 from selling my home. I currently have it in a money market. Is there a better place for it? The person goes on to say, my current home is paid for. I'm 1 to 2 years away from retirement. I have no outstanding debts. Not a bad place to be.
That's a great place to be. I sold a home, and if it was a residential home, I'm not clear they bought another home or what, but typically when you sell a home and you have $100,000 of profit, you pay no tax on that because there's a rule that says that if you are single and you have lived in that home through the last 5 years and you sell it, then the first $250,000 of profit, to the extent there is a profit, is not subject to tax. And if you are married, up to $500,000. Even in these bad times, people can make profits on homes. Otherwise, you may have a capital gain. But it sounds like this is after-tax money sitting in a money market 1 to 2 years from retirement. And I really don't have enough information. I need to know, do you have pension funds, profit-sharing plans, retirement funds? Do you have Social Security coming in? What is the entire story? So it's a little bit difficult, but it is not an unreasonable time to have a substantial amount of money in cash. And this is something else that goes back to my couch potato portfolio. Remember, that's an investment in equities. Okay? That may only be 25% of your overall net worth. It may only be 40 or 50%. There is definitely a place for having fixed income, which includes money markets, just like our emailer. And it may be indeed prudent, but I really don't have enough information to react. But is there a better place to put that money if you want to stay in fixed income at the current time? Maybe a portion of it could be in a very short-term corporate bond fund, okay, with a duration of maybe a couple of years. There are a number of those mutual funds out there. You might even look at some type of intermediate Ginnie Mae fund. Those have held up very, very well if you are interested in fixed income. But again, at the current time, I really can't fault having money in a money market fund.
All right. Here's another question. The person listening says, my wife and I have some money, around $10,000, to invest. We have retirement plans, one at the U of I in CSRS, the other with Carl. She also has a Roth IRA. Are there tax advantages to investing in the Roth? Should we split up the deposit across the board? Any general advice?
Well, there are significant tax advantages, of course, in investing in a Roth. Remember, you are taking after-tax dollars, and if you have $10,000 in this money market account, presumably those are after-tax dollars. Presumably you are both working, so it would make sense to continue to fund those Roths. After all, one, you've got the money, it's after-tax money, and two, eventually, when you distribute money out of a Roth, so long as you've been in it at least 5 years and you are of normal retirement age, the distribution, including the earnings coming out of that Roth, inure to you tax-free, not tax-deferred. So does it make good sense to put money into a Roth? I think so. I think that would be an excellent place. Then the question becomes, okay, so we're going to put money in a Roth, but what's the investment vehicle? Well, again, that depends on your time horizon. If you're willing to commit to a balanced fund, for example, where 40 to 50% at all time is in fixed income and 40 to 50% at all time is in equities, that might be a reasonable investment. And again, keep in mind that you could average in. You don't have to put the $5,000 in all at once. Mm-hmm. You could put $1,000 a month for 6 months into your Roth, for example.
All right. I hope that helps. Here's caller in Urbana. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Am I one?
Yes, go ahead.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Does the price of silver travel along with the price of gold? In other words, when gold goes up, does silver go up?
Well, generally, they both may go up, but interestingly enough, gold has gone up relative to silver. So a lot of professional traders are long gold and short silver, which means they buy the gold and they sell the silver because gold seems to be more in demand than silver. But nevertheless, silver also has gone up. So,
is that perhaps because silver is more available?
Well, it is. It is. It's more available, and it has never really been thought of as the true storehouse of wealth,
right,
psychologically, like gold.
Right.
So are you thinking of buying silver?
No, I'm thinking of selling a set of beautiful sterling silverware.
And a lot of people are thinking about doing that.
Before the price goes down.
Mm-hmm, before the price goes down.
Okay.
And I really can't advise you because that's an emotional issue. Your sterling set, probably from your wedding or family or whatever.
Right.
So that's a tough call.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this hour of Focus. And our guest is David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month, on Friday, he's here. We talk about money management and investing. And if you have a specific question, I'm sure we could have time to get at least one more person in here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
There are periods of time in any economy where things look very, very grim. Very grim indeed. And historically, those have turned out to be some of the greatest investment opportunities of a lifetime. And if there are young people who are listening today, college graduates, even 25, 30, 35 years of age, where your time horizon is 30, 35 years, I think the opportunities are extraordinary. I think the opportunities are enormous. And if I was 35 years of age, I would be dollar cost averaging into the stock market, into indexes like there are no tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Also, I think that housing represents some tremendous opportunities. While a lot of people, including RealtyTrack, Zillow, et cetera, Case-Shiller Index is suggesting that housing may go down another 3 to 5% over the next 12 months, we're never going to figure out where we're going to bottom. And I think for younger people who have good paying jobs, who are secure, I think it's an enormous opportunity to step in with a single family dwelling. And I think we're going to look back as in this period of time for kicking ourselves and not stepping in front of the freight train and saying, let's at least put some money at risk. I see our program's almost over, and David, you've got four
lines.
Suddenly
the lines have all
lit
up. Well, isn't that the way it often works? We'll try to get at least a couple of callers here. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. This time next year, I'm going to be debt-free, and I will have about $2,000 left over from expenses. And I heard that lady talk about a Roth IRA. Is that something I could start getting?
Yes. Do you have income? Are you working?
I'm sorry?
Do you have income or are you working?
No, I'm retired, but my wife works.
Okay. Well, she could certainly put $2,000 into a Roth IRA. You have to have earned income to put money into a Roth IRA. So if you took $2,000 of your money, put it into a Roth, then let it grow for 5 years, and hopefully it will grow. You can pull it all out tax-free. And there's no rule that you ever have to pull it out. You can leave it to your beneficiary. So I could suggest my daughter. She would make an excellent beneficiary. So you probably get my point. So I think it's an excellent use of $2,000.
Does it cost money to get somebody to get you an IRA?
No, you can go online to a mutual fund company. They'll do it for free. You can go to a bank and open up a Roth IRA. No, you shouldn't pay anything to open one up.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Well, okay, we'll go to another caller here, Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Yes, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the advantages of a trust for estate planning. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the shows. Yeah. Very useful.
Thank you. Well, very, very quickly, a trust is a private legal document where you are the maker of the trust called a grantor. You often are your own trustee, and then you have beneficiaries. And at your death, the trust assets do not pass through a probate estate. They go directly to a named beneficiary. And for very, very wealthy Americans who have a net worth in excess of $5 million, a trust setup is just a given. It's an absolute necessity because it also can reduce federal estate taxes on the next generation. So very, very quickly, in a nutshell, if you are wealthy, it's a great estate planning vehicle for a lot of reasons I could go into. Secondly, a trust is a private document. It's not probated. It doesn't go through the probate estate. It's like life insurance paid directly to a named beneficiary. It's like a retirement account, which is paid directly to a named beneficiary, which really means that it's beyond the claws of creditors. So, for example, if I was a spendthrift and I had $100,000 of credit card debt at my death and I had a trust, which was substantial, and my beneficiary was my wife, Carol, there's nothing in the probate estate for the credit card companies to get to. So they would be left out in a limb, and my beneficiary would receive my assets, not subject to my personal credit card debt. So in a nutshell, it may make sense, depending on your personal situation. I would caution you, and I would suggest that you talk to an estate planning lawyer.
All right. Well, there, we'll have to leave it this time around with the promise that Dave will be back again. David Sinnoh is a clinical professor of finance in the University of Illinois College of Business, and once a month on a Friday, he is here, and we talk about money management, and we have a little computer problem. We'll get that straightened out, and hopefully within the next day or two, if not sooner, we'll get the update of the Couch Potato Portfolio on there, so you can go to our website, will.illinois.edu, and check it out. Thank you.
Dave, thanks so much.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square this Saturday morning at 7, featuring Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information online at urbanaillinois.us/market.
We're going to take a break here. We usually do, so we can bring you an update on the markets and some news. We'll be back with more Focus. Stay tuned.
Support is provided by Risk Management Commodities, presenting an Agricultural Outlook meeting at the Beck Ag Center at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, on Tuesday, August 23rd at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Lee Goss from EFG in Chicago will be there. More information is available at 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. We're significantly higher all across the grain picks. Part of the reason is the U.S. dollar, which is significantly softer today. The dollar index currently at 73.913. It's had a high price on the day at 74.46 to give you an idea of how much it has fallen on the day. All of that, of course, plus